This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, tracing your family roots. Genealogy expert Tony Burrows is our guest. Burrows has been practicing genealogy for some 20 years. He teaches genealogy at Chicago State University, and he's written and lectured extensively on the subject. Tony Burrows will talk with us about some of the basic resources for tracking family histories and take your telephone calls. Tony Burrows has a special interest in African-American genealogy. He is African-American, and he was the genealogy expert for the African-American segment on the PBS series Ancestors. In 1996, Tony Burrows received the Distinguished Service Award from the National Genealogical Society. He is co-author of the African-American Genealogical Sourcebook. He is the president of Black Roots, and he is past curator of the African American Genealogy Collection at the Avalon branch of the Chicago Public Library. Tracking family histories, our topic in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. Your telephone calls are welcome and encouraged. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Outside Champaign-Urbana, wherever you're listening, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL, and in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Tony Burrows joins us from the Radio Hall of Fame studios at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tony Burrows, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste. How are you doing?
I'm fine. And you?
I'm doing great.
Pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you.
Why did you become interested in genealogy?
Well, I became interested in genealogy. It's kind of like, I guess I was in college at Southern Illinois University, and I had the opportunity to attend a lecture by Alex Haley in 1969. And at that time, no one had ever heard of the word genealogy, let alone know that African Americans could actually do it. And I was just mesmerized by listening to his story. And after that, I said, well, one day before I die, I'd really like to do some genealogical research. And about 6 years later, I was waiting for Thanksgiving dinner to be prepared and reading the newspaper and saw an article on tracing your family tree. And I thought about it, and I said, wow, I remember Alex talked about that. So I read the article, and it talked about a book that you could pick up. And I ran out and got the book and started interviewing my mom, my dad, and really got fascinated about the genealogy. And I just got hooked. And after that, you know, I've been researching for 20 years.
Now, when did that interest in family, in genealogy, broaden to become the career it's become for you?
Oh, I guess about 9 or 10 years ago, I had stayed out of genealogy for a while because I had gotten so much information, I just couldn't process it all. I got what I call information overload.
Uh-huh.
So I stayed away from it for a while, and that's before personal computers were invented. And then sometime, I guess, in the early 80s, after computers had come out and I was using computers, I started dibbling and dabbling back into genealogy from a long hiatus. And I joined a genealogical society in Chicago, and people recognized immediately that I had a lot of experience. So they started asking me to give lectures and help them with their research. Mm. And then they wanted to be an officer in the society. So at that point, there were a lot of demands and requests placed upon me, and I started getting more involved in the organizational level as versus just the personal research level.
Yeah.
And then just one thing led to another, and I just started doing a lot of lecturing, and then I realized that I should write some of these things down, so I started writing articles and chapters and books and things.
Yeah, you mentioned information overload. I want to tell the audience that your research spans 200 years, three family lines going back six generations, and two lines back seven generations.
Right.
What What does that look like in terms of your own family documents and what you've amassed over the years? Does it take a whole room up in the house?
A room? A little more than that.
Yeah.
I started off using a notebook, and I guess we use notebooks based on, when we're in elementary school, we always have a notebook we carry to school every day, and we have little dividers with our chapters, our classes in there. And I started off that way, and after not too long, the binding burst on the notebook because it was so thick with information. So at some point in time, I realized this notebook is not going to work.
Yeah.
So I ended up getting, I had a two-drawer file cabinet. So I started reorganizing everything and putting it in this two-drawer file cabinet. And before long, that two-drawer file cabinet was filled up. So then I got a four-drawer file cabinet, and now I've got about six four-drawer file cabinets.
Wow.
In addition to some document cases where I have, some original documents and photographs and things. So it's a huge system at this point, and we're not even talking about what I have in my computer.
Yeah.
But it can become overwhelming. So you have to kind of anticipate that and organize your system so that you're able to actually retrieve documents when you need them, file them when you collect new documents, and then be able to select what you need when you're ready to do some analysis or send some information to other researchers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to definitely talk about, practical tips for getting this process underway and keeping it going, because I'm sure that there are dead ends along the way. But before we do that, let's take a call. We've got a caller waiting for us on line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm interested in beginning an oral history project within my family. I was wondering, is there any guidance you can give me on interviewing relatives, or maybe there's guides available with suggested questions? I'm just going to listen to your answer over the radio, okay?
Sure.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to say the young lady is very, very wise in starting off with oral history. Oftentimes when people start doing their genealogical research, they go to the library or they go on the internet not realizing that their relatives are the most vital pieces of their genealogical puzzle. And their relatives will not be here for eternity. They only have a limited lifespan. So she's very, very wise in talking about starting an oral history project. There's a lot of good books and also articles available in the library on doing oral histories and talking about a lot of the technical aspects of the equipment that you should use and making a person comfortable when you're interviewing them and all those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I would like to point out is that one of the pitfalls that we fall into as genealogists, when we interview our relatives, what we try to do is we try to find out what they remember about all the older ancestors. And invariably what will happen is a person, no matter how old they are, and depending on, what their memory is, some of them will say, well, I didn't know my great-great-great-grandfather, And then we get upset and we say that relative didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
Where, in effect, there's two areas that we really need to pursue when we're doing that oral history interviewing. One, yes, we want to know who were the person's parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents, and what they know as far as they can go back about all the other relatives and ancestors. But the part that we skip over and we take for granted is the fact that we really need to ask questions about the person that we're interviewing. When were they born? Where did they live? Who were the relatives around when they were small? And where was the house? How long did they live in that house? What were all the relatives that lived in that household? You want to recreate a biography on the person that you're interviewing in addition to finding out what they remember about older relatives and ancestors. And I think that's the most, the biggest error that people make when they do oral history. So if we can think about trying to recreate a biography of that person that we're interviewing as well as finding out what they remember about other relatives, I think we'll be far, far, far ahead of the game. But again, I really applaud the caller for wanting to concentrate on oral history.
Yeah. It seems to me you want a lot of detail. You might want to know where the schools they went to,
Yes.
And the church they belong to.
Yes. We want to ask a million questions. When a person is 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years old, and you're trying to recreate their life,
mm-hmm.
you can't do that in an hour or 2 hours. We need as much detail as possible. One interview will last either an hour or 2 hours, but I recommend after they interview that person that they study everything that that person said and transcribe the interview. Naturally, you want to tape record that interview, either on your audio tape or your video recorder, but you want to transcribe that interview and then study the things that the person said. And you use that for follow-up questions to go back to that person again and get more detail about each and every facet of their life. You want to get as much detail as possible because when you're first starting off, you don't know what's going to be important or what's not going to be important, so you need to record everything. The other thing is that depending on what they tell us, it will determine what records might exist that will further, you know, broaden our research. For example, if they mention the school that they went to, there might be records of the school, and there might be other relatives that attended that school. They mention the church that they attended. The church might have records at the church level as well as the organizational level larger than the church. If they owned their house, then there would be land records. So there's all kinds of records that exist that when people start off interviewing, they really don't know that all these records exist. So therefore, we have to ask as many questions as possible and go into as much depth and detail as possible. The other thing is that when you're interviewing a person, you might have a list of questions that you can get from a book on oral history or a genealogy book. But if the person starts to branch off from your question and goes into a story, just relax, listen, learn, and get that story that they're talking about, because those anecdotal stories will be very important later on down the road, and we don't want to make value judgments on what's important and what's not important. We want to get as much detail as possible.
I have an article from the Chicago Defender, Tony, where Letitia Greggs did a piece on you and looking back for one's family roots. And your number one tip that you told Letitia Greggs for this article was, number one, write your autobiography.
Right.
That makes so much sense.
Sure. Sure. You know, we take for granted that we don't know anything about the family history because we've not pursued it. But if you sit down and close your eyes and think about your own life and where you were born and when you grew up and who was around the house and what you did on birthdays, on holidays, if you had family reunions, if you lived in an extended family where other family members lived in your household, you'll realize that you know much, much more about the family history than you really say you do, just because of the fact that you've never thought about it, you've never concentrated on it. So you're right, the very first thing to do is to sit down and write your own autobiography. The other thing that happens is, I've talked to many, many researchers all around the country, many of them senior citizens that have been researching for years. And when I ask them what have they done about their own life, invariably they say nothing. So it's really kind of ironic that a person can go out and research all of their ancestors, and they pass away, and then their children pick up their research, and they go through it and try to answer the question, well, what did mom leave about herself and her life, and there's nothing in the record. So again, that's another reason why you should really concentrate on your autobiography and get that story down while it's fresh in your mind. And once you think about your early life, that will raise natural questions that you're going to want to answer. And when you start to interview relatives, some of those questions that you did not understand about your life will lead into those particular questions. The other thing is that when someone dies and you're researching that ancestor, you have a limited number of resources that you could research on that ancestor. There might be people that know that ancestor that you can ask questions of. They might have left records in libraries and archives and county courthouses. But what you're doing is you're doing research to try to reconstruct that person's life. Now, sometimes you're going to make mistakes because you're going to misinterpret some of the things that that person said.
Mm.
But when you're writing your autobiography, You have the one and only opportunity to not only tell people what you did, but why you did the things you did during your lifetime. Why you chose the fork in the road to the left rather than the one to the right, and explain why you made those decisions. And everybody has, you know, life is nothing but a series of decisions all throughout. But do people understand why you made those hard decisions? And when you've lived to be, you know, a senior citizen, you've overcome many, many struggles. You've had many, many decisions to make. And naturally, you've made some successful decisions. Otherwise, you would not be here right now. So the autobiography is the opportunity that we have to talk about our life and explain why we did the things that we did.
Do you have your autobiography done?
I have quite a bit of it done. I haven't published it yet. I have a lot of it written. I have a lot of it that I've typed up in the computer. And I've actually sat down and recorded a lot of it on audio tape also. Oftentimes when I'm on the highway, if I'm driving to a location for research or for lecturing, I'll take my tape recorder and I'll use that as an opportunity to record different periods of my life. So I've got the majority of it done. I still have yet to put it in its final form and have it published.
Yeah, and of course it's a work in progress.
Yes, exactly. It's always a work in progress. Yeah. We talk about the autobiography of Frederick Douglass, and he had about four different versions of his autobiography, which he had published at various times throughout his life.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon, genealogy expert Tony Burrows. If you'd like to talk with us this afternoon about tracing your family roots, give us a call. If you're listening in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Toll free, if you're outside Champaign-Urbana, you can call us. It won't cost you anything. 1-800-222-9455. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Another caller is waiting for us on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. I got bitten by the genealogy bug about 2 years ago, I guess, and was fortunate enough to take a class with a friend who's a genealogist, and she said a lot of things that you're saying, and she also said to cast your net widely for information, because that helps to give a picture of a person's life if you look for their siblings and their neighbors and their relatives. In doing that with one of my husband's branches of his ancestral tree, I found a maiden aunt who was living with another woman on her own little piece of farmland, and I don't know particularly why there were two women living together, but there's more than one possibility. And I, in poking around and looking more than just for that direct ancestor or ancestress, I've begun to get pictures of what people's lives were like, and it's really opened up history for me, and it's kind of like doing a jigsaw puzzle, but you had to look for the pieces too, before you can put the whole thing together. I ran across an interesting book this spring. I think it's a newly published, perhaps. It's called, I think, Uncovering Your Female Ancestors. And I think the author's name is something like Couch. I can't put my hand on the book right at the moment. But one of her suggestions for dealing with people that you can't quite get much information on is to research the history of that time period, the social history, and learn what that person's life might have been like based on what it was like for other people of the same situation and sex and race and so forth. Oh, and I also wanted to say that the local, for people who are living nearby, the Urbana Archives in the basement of the Urbana Library has a lot of, has a nice little library and some paper tools that you can use to get started. They, for instance, have for $1.50 you can buy a family tree chart that starts out in a normal 8.5 by 11 size, but you unfold it and it turns into 9 panels. And you can record not only your direct ancestors on one line, but you follow both lines and it spreads out. So you get the female ancestors, not just the male ancestors of your family name. And there's room to record siblings and dates about them. And that helps people figure out whether somebody could have been the parent of somebody else, if you know the age ranges of the children. I'm enjoying listening to you.
Well, thank you very much for your telephone call this afternoon. Tony, any comments?
Yes. Fortunately, the caller had some very good... Absolutely right. We have people research what we call collateral ancestors, and those are the brothers and sisters of your direct ancestor. Because if a person, let's say your grandparent had five brothers and sisters, what's there to guarantee that your grandparent was the one to have all the information about your great-grandparent? Any one of those five or six siblings could have tons of information, and it's not always your direct ancestor. So she's absolutely right. We need to trace all of the people in the family, and you'll find out that you'll get different pieces of the puzzle from each and every one of those particular individuals. In terms of studying the social history, again, she's absolutely right. You cannot really place your ancestor into context until you start studying the history of the time period that she lived in. And when we talk about studying history, we're talking about it at several different levels. We're talking about United States history. We're talking about the local history, which is, you know, the local history of that community. And there's county histories on most counties throughout the United States, as well as there's always the newspaper that will give you the day-to-day events in that particular community. And then we're also talking about ethnic history, whether the person is Jewish, whether they're Polish, whether they're African-American, or they're from Czechoslovakia, wherever they're from, there's usually an ethnic history to that particular community, as well as locally, as well as nationally. So studying all those different types of history, then we begin to place our ancestor into historical context, and it will give us other additional clues on where to look and what kinds of things they were doing at that particular time period. So you've got some smart callers.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, doing that kind of research, you know, informing yourself about the history and the culture and place, all these things really put flesh on the family story.
Absolutely.
Which is what makes it so fascinating.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You just don't want to collect names and dates. You need to try to find out what kind of personality did they have, what kind of struggles faced them throughout their lives, and it's those kinds of things. I suggest, you know, to experienced genealogists that after you get so far, and you really should do this along the way, but so many people don't, you need to get out of the genealogy department of the library and go into the history department of the library and just start studying, you know, all those different histories, and you'll find out that it becomes very, very exciting, and you know, you really start to make them into real individuals. I've always had a great love for history, and to me, genealogy is really a window to history. Mm-hmm. And we found that genealogy helps a lot of students have an appreciation of history and get into history at an earlier age, whereas, you know, when they see, one of the problems with history is the fact that historians have written history from what we call the top down. They've written about the wealthy, they've written about the politicians, they've written about the famous people and their major events. But what they have not done a good job at is talking about the common person and what's going on, you know, with the workers and the people at the lower level that never became famous. And now historians are starting to look at that, and they're starting to relook at history from the bottom up rather than the top down. And this is the kind of approach that genealogists use, and this is the kind of thing that I think gets people excited about history, whereas before they were kind of turned off because they never saw a connection between them and history or their ancestors in history. And we need a thing that's going to help us make a connection with that so we can identify with it. And then people get very excited about history.
Mm. Let's take another call. On line two, another caller in Urbana. Hi.
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 Listen, I was wondering if you had some advice or some tips for our family situation. My wife's family especially is from Europe, and the parts of Europe they're from, the borders have changed, and so there's a lot of problems with accessing old records. If I knew what records were there, I might not know where they were, whether they had survived various political upheavals and what language they might be written in, and I don't speak anything but English. So, you know, there's no magic solution, but I was wondering if you had some advice or some tips, or if there are any organizations that help people in that situation.
Sure. Since we were just talking about history, the first thing you'd want to do is to start to research the history of that country and the history of that ethnic group, and particularly around the time period that your ancestors lived there. You might not know exact dates of when they live, but at least you know you want to get an overall ballpark figure. So once you know that time period, to start, again, going to the history department of the library as well as the geography department of the library and start getting a real understanding about the history of that country, the geography of that country, and the people of that country. Depending on which ethnic group and which country it is, if you go into the genealogy department, there's genealogy guides to every country and every ethnic group that exists. So, again, the genealogy department will help you with that. If you run across a book or some kind of guide that the library doesn't have, then the reference librarian can do an OCLC search to show you who has that guide, and you can either have that sent through interlibrary loan to your closest library, or you might want to travel to that location and view that particular guide. There's also a lot of resources that will help you to use geography and maps and trying to pinpoint, say, towns that no longer exist or names that have been changed. So there's a lot of genealogy guides as well as, you know, the geography department, again, within your library can help you with some of those guides. In terms of locating records, the Family History Library of the Mormon Church goes around the world, and they microfilm original records all throughout the United States and all throughout the world. Once they do that, they make two copies of those records. One copy of the record, they will leave with the custodian of the record, whoever it is that owns those records. The other copy will be sent to Salt Lake City, Utah, as part of the Family History Library that's owned by the Mormon Church. Once they do that, you can either go to Salt Lake City to view those records on microfilm. But the other thing is that they have branches all throughout the country where you can go to a local branch and order that film and have that film sent to that branch library. And they have about, I think, 1,500 branches throughout the United States. And I'm sure there's probably some in the Champaign, Urbana area where you can look in your telephone directory under Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they will let you know where the closest library is. So instead of, you know, hopping on a plane and, say, flying to Paris, France to do some research, you could check at the Family History Library, go through their card catalog, see what records they have for France, and then see which one of those might be applicable to what you want to research, and have a microfilm copy of those records sent right to your local branch library. It's a branch of the Mormon History Library. So people can do international research very, very close to their home. But the key, first of all, is to find a guide for either that country or for that ethnic group. And there's a lot that has been published.
Great. Thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. The Mormon Church, the Church of Latter-day Saints, these records would involve folks that aren't Mormon?
Oh, sure, sure. When they microfilm records, they would say come into, say, the county courthouse, and they would microfilm birth records, death records, marriage records, probate records, land records, and it doesn't matter who's in those records, they microfilm the totality of those records. And in many instances, there's no Mormons listed in any of the records. And that's not their objective, is to just microfilm copies of Mormon records.
Mm-hmm.
Their objective is to microfilm original records that have a genealogical value, no matter what the ethnic group or the geographic location or whatever. So they have teams of microfilmers that are literally around the world microfilming original records.
Wow. Let's talk with another caller. Online for a caller waiting for us in Eureka. Hello.
Hi, a comment and a question, please.
Sure.
I think the Mormons do it because of their doctrine of the baptism of the dead, where they can get the converts and get the whole family into their kingdom, if my memory is correct. My question is, I wonder if the guest has seen a point of view documentary that has to do with a white Southern man who goes back to try to trace his family roots and finds out that several generations back his family was one of the biggest slaveholding families in North Carolina, and I believe the name was Alston. It was on last night at our local PBS station, and I found it quite interesting.
What was the family name?
Alston.
Alston. No, I'm sorry, I did not see that.
I guess they're on at different times, but it was quite interesting. He was doing exactly the same thing that you were doing, and he showed a part of his white family having a family reunion, and then the black family that was descended from the slave owning part of it.
Quite informative. Yeah, I think that program is coming up on our companion station, WILL TV Channel 12, in the future, because last night I saw a promotional notice for it on our companion station. So that's something that folks might want to check their listings for. It looks really fascinating.
It's especially the black and white components of it for me were very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. Maybe this would be a good opportunity to talk about some of the challenges that face African Americans as they look for their family roots. In this PBS program, Point of View program, that's coming up, it's a white man who is looking for his family history, and he learns that this is my understanding from that brief little ad that was on the television last night, that he finds out that he has African-American relatives, blood relatives. But for African-Americans, would slave owners, would that be... would that be a place to, families that held slaves, would that be a place to look?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the biggest challenges that African-American genealogists face. The Emancipation Proclamation was written, was declared law on January 1st, 1863. But that only legally freed slaves that were in Union-held areas of the South. It did not free all the slaves. After the Civil War was over, amendments were passed to legally free all African Americans throughout the United States. Prior to 1863 and the Civil War, the majority of African Americans were slaves. Not all. And there were approximately 200,000 or a little over 200,000 free African Americans in the North prior to the Civil War. There were another 200,000 free in the South prior to the Civil War. So when we get back to the Civil War period, we can't assume that all our ancestors were slaves because all of them weren't. However, the vast majority of them were. And when we get back into the slavery period, what we have to do is understand what slavery was about and understand some of the details or many of the details that had to do with slavery. African Americans were considered property, and this was a myth that the slave owners were trying to perpetuate. And as this myth of property of human beings, we were not allowed legally to have last names. We were only referred to by first names. We were not legally able to marry, although there were slave marriages and there were slave families and slave households. But we could not vote. We were prohibited from reading, from writing, from owning property, from testifying in court. And any of those things that normal citizens took for granted, we did not have those things available to us. So when we get back to the slavery period, our research differs radically from other Americans. Mm-hmm. What we have to do, first of all, even before we research the slavery period, is we have to identify who was the former slave owner. Unfortunately, this kind of information has not been passed down through oral history over the last 150 years since the Civil War was over. Alex Haley was someone who's very fortunate that had that passed down from generation to generation. But in my travels and lectures and teachings and research over the last 20 years, I find that that's really a rarity. Mm-hmm. The majority of African Americans do not have that information. And unfortunately, what they've done is they've made assumptions on who that former slave owner was. For example, if my name is Burroughs, then I made an assumption that the slave owner that owned my ancestors was named Burroughs. And when I met a relative through doing genealogical research and told me that our common ancestor had property that was given to her by the slave owner, I went down to South Carolina and I found where that property was. And I went in the land records and I found the deed when she acquired that property in the 1870s. And I know who she acquired that property from. And when I saw who the person it was that she transferred the property to her, his name was not Burroughs at all. And when I checked the slave records, then sure enough, he was an owner of slaves. So I was like really in a quandary. Well, to make a long story short, I've been doing research ever since then, and I found out that in the vast majority of the cases, the last slave owner that owned our ancestors did not have a common surname, the same name as our ancestors. In fact, from my research of over 5,000 cases, it only occurred in 15% of the situations. So if we're going to assume that our slave owner that owned our ancestors had the same surname as our ancestor, 85% of the time, we're going to be on a wild goose chase. Mm. So one of the things that I do for researchers is I give them specific instructions and techniques on how to identify that slave owner. Because, you know, you cannot do any slave genealogy until you first identify that slave owner that owned your ancestors. Once you do that, then what you have to do is do the genealogy of that slave owner and see what he did with his property, because our ancestors were bought and sold just like cattle and grain. So we're doing two genealogies at that point. We're doing the genealogy of our ancestor, and in addition, we're doing the genealogy of the slave owner and see what he did with his property. Oftentimes, the property was sold, but in many cases, that property was transferred down from generation to generation to generation. So our research gets extremely difficult at that point. Not to say it's not difficult even up until that point.
Are there points when you just feel absolutely frustrated?
Well, yes, there are times that are very, very trying. But if you've done your research broad and detailed back to that point, then what will happen is when you get frustrated, you hit a brick wall and you can't go any further, then, you know, you could research to another family line. And that's what I did. When I first started researching, I found out that my ancestors were from South Carolina, and I started researching South Carolina. Then when I came into a roadblock, well, even before I came into a roadblock, I found out that I had a grandmother's sister that was still living in Pennsylvania. My great-great-grandmother's sister was living in Pennsylvania. And I said I wanted to get to them while they were alive, so I stopped everything in South Carolina, transferred and started researching Pennsylvania, and my ancestors had been in Pennsylvania for 200 years, which I didn't know about until I started doing my research. So when I went to Pennsylvania, I met all these cousins I had never known, so I interviewed all of them. I interviewed my grandmother's sister, her husband, and all their children. I interviewed my great-grandmother's sister, and then all the people that were living with her. So I totally shifted from doing research in South Carolina and concentrated on Pennsylvania. Then I went back to South Carolina, did some more things in South Carolina, and actually found out that research I had been doing in the South helped things I was doing in the North, and vice versa. So when I came into a roadblock and did all I could on one line, then I just switched to another line, started researching that, and found out that, you know, those other different lines helped me with my research.
Mm-hmm. You never know where these things are going to lead you, and this can have a profound impact on one's life, can it?
Well, that's, to me, the most exciting thing about genealogy is that you never know what's going to happen. You never know where you're going to go. You never know what you're going to learn. I just came back from lecturing in Canada a couple of weeks ago. And on the way to Canada, I stopped in Detroit, did a little bit of research at the public library in Detroit. And one of the reference librarians pointed out one of the African-American researchers that was there. And we chatted for a moment, and she knew about me and knew my surname and asked me, was I related to other Burroughs in Chicago? And I said, no, I'm familiar with this other family, but I haven't been able to find any connection with them. And their ancestors go back to Alabama, and mine came from South Carolina, and I never found any connection. She said, yes, I know. Mine were from South Carolina, too, and they migrated to Alabama, and that's where the connection comes. And they migrated at such an earlier period than the research that I had been doing, because I had not got back as far as she did. So that was, you know, I just found that out 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
So now I'm going to get in contact with the other relatives here in Chicago and let them know that, yes, I think we're related. And in fact, after this interview is over, I'm going up to the Newberry Library to pursue that research. So you're always running across new information, and what's a roadblock today will probably be opened up sometime tomorrow. The other thing that happened was my research in Pennsylvania, I had found out that one of my ancestors had actually fought in the War of 1812, and that I had, again, never heard about. It was never passed down through oral history. And just this summer, they had a series of what they call tall ships that came into Chicago for people to tour them. One of them was the brig Niagara from the War of 1812, which just happened to be the vessel that my ancestors served on. So I was able to go down there, tour the vessel, talk to the crew, and it was a very, very exciting experience, one that I hadn't even planned on.
Mm. I have some information, by the way, now on that Point of View program on PBS. It's called Breaking Generations of Silence Over Slavery, or that's what it's about. And the name, actually, the title of this POV program is Family Name. And it airs in the Champaign-Urbana market in central Illinois at 10:30 this Sunday evening. That's Sunday, September 20th. And the description I have here is it reads, as a child growing up in North Carolina, Mackie Alston never gave much thought to the fact that many of his elementary school classmates, black elementary school classmates, shared his last name. At the age of 27, he discovered that the Alstons were one of the largest slave-owning families in antebellum North Carolina. And this is his film about his story, chronicling the twists and turns of his search for the descendants of the slaves and slave owners who lived on the plantations once owned by his family. That must be an amazing road to walk down for that man, Mackie Alston.
Yeah, absolutely. Now that you read back the story, I did hear a little bit about it. I didn't know they were going to make it into a television program. There's a book that just came out this year by Edward Ball called Slaves in the Family, which actually deals with South Carolina, who was one of the largest slave-owning families in South Carolina. And Ball was doing a book tour back, I believe it was in February, and he was on public radio, did an hour interview, and I think someone from that Austin family called in, because now that you read the description, it definitely rings a bell.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interest seems to be growing in this field, in genealogy. You mentioned that when you first heard Alex Haley, no one knew the word. Today, genealogy is, you know, all around us, it seems that people are searching for their family roots. Why do you suppose we're so interested?
Well, I think that genealogy is something that's innate within us. I think it's a natural curiosity, something that, you know, we're all human beings, we're all individuals, we all have a name, we all have a personality, we all have a family. And I think trying to understand how our family goes back deeper than just our immediate family, I think it's something that we all have within us, whether we choose to explore it or not. I know many people say, I don't want to know about anything about those dead folks, you know, and I don't want to, you know, go into any skeletons in the closet. But I think that it's something innate within every individual that they just have a natural curiosity about our beginnings and about our roots.
Yeah. I suppose we should all be prepared for some skeletons, huh?
Oh, yes. We all have them.
Yeah. Which is comforting somehow to me. I don't know. But anyway, looking at my own ups and downs in life, it's nice to know that other people have been there with me. Mm-hmm. There are lots of genealogical conferences out there now. Do you have advice for selecting a conference to attend to? What do you look for in terms of, you know, is this going to be a good place for me to fit in, and am I going to get good information here at this conference?
Sure. There's probably about three different levels of conferences. You have genealogy conferences at the national level. You also have them at the state level. And then you have local conferences, either given by a genealogy society or a public library. Where you get usually the best information is from a national conference. There's two national organizations that have conferences twice a year. One is the National Genealogical Society, which is headquartered in, I believe it's Arlington, Virginia. It's a suburb of Washington, D.C., but it's the National Genealogical Society. And next year, their conference is going to be held in Richmond, Virginia in May. I don't have the exact date, but it's called the National Genealogical Society. They have a website, which is not difficult to find. They have an office in the Washington, D.C. area, and any, again, reference librarian will help you get the address. They have a newsletter that comes out, I think, every other month. They have a journal that comes out four times a year, so they're not hard to locate. And their conference runs 3 to 4 days, and there's about 7 sessions for every time period. So there's over 100 sessions just on all different aspects of genealogy. Mm-hmm. The other national organization is called the Federation of Genealogical Societies, and that's the umbrella group for all the genealogical societies in the country. And their conference is going to be in St. Louis, Missouri next year, which is very easy
close.
To get in contact with
mm-hmm.
all our Illinois listeners. And that's going to be in August of next year at the, I think it's the Regal Hotel in St. Louis. And again, you can get that from any of your reference librarians can put you into them. Again, there'll be over 100 workshops and lectures on genealogy, and that's the Federation of Genealogical Societies.
Okay.
There's an Illinois Genealogical Society as well as local, you know, genealogical societies in different cities. So it's very easy. Most of them have websites, so people that are on the internet, it's very easy to find information about conferences. The other thing is that there's an organization called Repeat Performance. They're located in Hobart, Indiana, and they tape record lectures at these national conferences as well as state and regional conferences. And those tapes are available for sale. So if you're interested in a certain geographical area, a certain ethnic group, a certain kind of methodology, you can find a lecturer who's given a talk on the subject, and you can purchase a tape from Repeat Performance. And again, they're on the internet. You can get a list of the speakers on the internet, and you can also contact them by telephone. They're in Hobart.